It's Philosophy Talk.
The United States has taken lethal, targeted action against Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, including with remotely piloted aircraft commonly referred to as drones.
Is drone warfare morally better or morally worse than conventional warfare?
This new technology raises profound questions about accountability and morality.
Is drone warfare too cold, mechanical, and efficient to be morally acceptable?
It's a strange weapon in that it actually gives credible distance, but at the same time, a shocking level of intimacy.
Our guest is Bradley Strasser from the Naval Postgraduate School.
If you have this great weapon that in potential theory could be used more morally, but yet the way it's used is shrouded in mystery and darkness, we don't really know who we're killing.
Do drones really reduce the cost of going to war?
It's not a video game. You don't get PTSD from a video game.
The ethics of drone warfare. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, a program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our thinking originates across the bay at the corner, Philosopher's Corner, and on the Stanford University campus. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 wonderful years.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, today, we're talking about the ethics of drone warfare.
Well, that's timely, Ken, because in the last 6 years alone, 2,500 people have been killed by U.S. drone strikes. That's nine times as many drone attacks under President Obama than under his predecessor, George W.
You know, what I find really remarkable about that is the number of deaths on our side.
On our side? I suppose that's zero or close to it.
Yeah, because drones are precise, effective weapons that can reduce unintended casualties, and best of all, they don't even put our own soldiers at risk. That's a cool thing.
Well, you sound enthused. You sound like this is all a good thing.
Of course it's a good thing. How could it not be? Surely, you agree, it's morally preferable to use weapons that limit the number of intended and unintended casualties than to use ones that increase them, right?
Well, limited on one side. Our guys aren't in danger when we bomb Pakistan, Afghanistan, or wherever we're bombing on a given day. But what about those people? Hundreds of civilians, innocent civilians, have been killed by drones since Obama took office. How is that morally preferable?
Well, because you got to think about the base rate, John. Imagine what those numbers would be if we bombed those targets using less precise technology instead. There'd be many more civilian deaths. Surely, less is better than more.
Yeah, well, imagine what it'd be like if we didn't go around bombing places. That's a problem with drones. They make it too easy for the powers that be and powers that would be, like you, to bomb whomever they want without any political fallout.
You're confused, Don. You're objecting to U.S. foreign policy, not to drone warfare. Look, you got to keep separate things separate. There are two distinct moral questions here. Both deserve addressing. Question one, are drones morally preferable to other weapons used in war? Question two, do we have good reason to go to war, regardless of what weapon is being used?
Well, you're not getting my point. These questions get entangled in people's minds. When you make going to war politically too easy with technology like drones, you create a political culture in which people convince themselves that we ought to be fighting all kinds of stupid wars all over the place.
Well, but look, maybe there are also wars that we really should be fighting, but we lack the political will because we fear the possibility of high casualties for our servicemen. With drones, we can just X that consideration out. We don't have to worry about that. So we can fight wars just because they're the right thing to do, just because they're just.
Yeah, that's great. What the world needs more of now is war, sweet war. That's your opinion. And the idea of remote-controlled killing machines that bomb places in the Middle East because of what people do in South Dakota and North Dakota, Oh, it's just disgusting. It's dishonorable. It's cold. It's horrible.
John, I'm going to tell you this. Cold is a good thing in war. It means our soldiers can be calm and dispassionate and not have to act rashly or out of fear. They can take their time. They can choose their targets wisely, hit the targets precisely, making sure that there are no civilians around who could get killed. It's a great thing, John.
Well, like you're living in La La Land, Ken. I mean, drones kill lots of innocent civilians. Twice as many civilians have been killed by drones under Obama than were under Bush.
But don't blame the drones for that. There could be all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with the technology as such. You know, maybe the intelligence used to identify the target was bad, or the commander in charge simply didn't make avoiding civilians a high enough priority. That's not the fault of the drones.
Well, Ken, you're gung-ho about drones. But, you know, your defense is really based on some fantasy world in which they're never used to fight unjust wars. And innocent civilians are never killed. That's just unrealistic. You can't talk about the ethics of drones without talking about how they're actually used in the real world.
Okay, you want to get real. So let's get real. Let's talk about the real-life experiences of those directly controlling this technology. What does it feel like to operate a military drone? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shukran Kalantari, to talk to one of the first drone operators ever recruited by the U.S. Air Force. She files this report.
Brandon Bryant didn't plan on enlisting in the Air Force. It was kind of happenstance. One day he was dropping off his friend at the Army recruiter, and the Air Force recruiter was right next door.
And he was bored and didn't have a client in there, and so he was like, "Young man, come talk with me. Come have a seat." And I was like, "Okay."
Brandon was living with his single mom at the time, a public school teacher in Missoula, Montana. He told the recruiter he was struggling to afford college, and he was terrified of going into debt.
And he was like, "Well, the Air Force has its own accredited college." And of course, that was all the seed that he needed to plant. I had just turned 19.
That was 2005. Brandon planned on going into intelligence. A few months later, he was sent to the middle of the Nevada desert on a secret mission.
I showed up and they showed us a montage video of Hellfire missile shots and bad guys on the ground shooting, set to heavy metal music. And this guy walks down the center aisle of the 11th Reconnaissance Squadron. He turns around and he's like, "Your job is to kill people and break things." And I was like, "What? It's not what I signed up to do."
Brandon tried to back out, but it was too late. He was officially a sensor operator for the U.S. Air Force. He was going to fly drones. Soon after, Brandon killed his first target.
And they looked like three scared individuals walking along the road, not knowing what they were doing. And that we were told that they had weapons and we were going to shoot at them, and that was it.
Brandon says he was more afraid of not fulfilling his duty than taking another life. So he shot the three men.
And then as soon as the smoke cleared, I watched this guy rolling around on the ground, bleeding. And I watched him die. I watched him die. I watched him more than die. I watched him lose all of his body heat. And then they were like, "Ah, good shot."
Everyone started cheering and congratulating him, but Brandon felt sick.
I went out to my car and I tried to drive off a base, and the frickin' stoplight wouldn't turn green. I should have just gone through it, but I couldn't. I felt trapped. I was trapped on in this life, and I didn't like it. And after that, it was like robot mode. I went into robot mode after that.
Brandon would come home from base every night, get drunk, and play a bunch of video games. He'd also have nightmares in infrared. Then in 2011, Brandon went on his first leave. But the drinking and nightmares didn't stop. Eventually, he met a Vietnam vet who told him to get help.
He's like, "It took me 25 years, and you're doing the same thing that I was doing. You have the same mannerisms I did. Isolationism, anger at the world, hateful towards civilians especially, shame in my service, lots and lots and lots of drinking."
Brandon agreed to see a VA therapist. He was diagnosed with PTSD and depression. He's not alone. A study from the Department of Defense shows drone operators suffer from the same levels of depression, alcoholism, and suicidal thoughts as traditional combat fighters. It's now been 4 years since Brandon left the Air Force. Every week, he goes to a therapist meeting at the VA, and every day, he struggles with PTSD and depression. And he's homeless.
The depression and the PTSD get worse when I'm like, has this really been worth it? Like, I'm still a homeless veteran struggling along in the world.
If Brandon Bryant had not decided to drop off his friend at the Army recruiter 10 years ago, he might have been a graduate of the University of Montana today. Instead, he lives out of his car. Brandon says what keeps him going is doing good for others, sharing his story to whoever will listen, and advocating against the use of drone warfare. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kantari.
Thanks, Shuka. That was a very interesting piece. I hope the Air Force doesn't hire you away from Philosophy Talk to do recruitment. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our guest today is a professor of philosophy at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He's author of Killing by Remote Control, The Ethics of an Unmanned Military. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Bradley Strasser.
BJ, you teach ethics to naval students here in California at Monterey, and you've also taught in the Air Force Academy. Now, is this military setting that you ended up, you know, using your philosophy PhD to teach ethics in military schools? Is that what got you interested in drones?
Yes, absolutely. I never thought I'd end up teaching at a military institution, but there I was at the Air Force Academy, early in my academic career, and I'm teaching these bright, eager men and women, 21, 22-year-old undergraduate seniors who are about to become commissioned officers in the Air Force, most of them really excited to be pilots. They had grown up thinking they'd be a fighter pilot or some other really cool, in their mind, role in the Air Force, and then they saw the writing on the wall. As early as 2005, it was pretty apparent to most of them that looks like drones are taking over, and suddenly they realized, uh-oh, I might be a drone pilot, not a fighter pilot. And that's not nearly as sexy in their minds. And so they had a lot of concerns over this, so it was the perfect opportunity for me to dive into really wrestling with the questions this form of warfare raises.
So you go into the Air Force thinking you're going to be Tom Cruise in Top Gun, and you end up being, you know, Joe Nobody in South Dakota. That's right.
Of course, Tom Cruise is the Navy. The Navy guys would tell me. The military changed before their eyes, and they weren't ready for it.
Yeah, okay. So now, you've done a lot of research on drones and their effects. Now, Ken and I had this little back and forth. On the one side, the claim is drones disconnect soldiers from their enemies. They dehumanize the battlefield, and they make it too easy for politicians to go to war. On the other hand, the point is that operating with drones allows the people who are in charge of these weapons to be more precise, to reflect more on what they're doing, to be more careful, to avoid innocent casualties. So who's right, me as usual or Ken for a change?
Well, I've got good news and bad news for you. The good news is that, well, you're right, but so is Ken. You're both right. But you're actually both very much wrong as well.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because there's a surprisingly deep moral tension here and a really surprising philosophical puzzle. And that's the fact that the no question undeniable ways that the technology has the potential for moral improvement is exactly the things that drive the systemic worries that you have that they could be used therefore more wrongly. It's a strange juxtaposition of unquestionable moral gains and potential, but those actual gains themselves drive the potential misuse
in
actuality.
But isn't the technology itself just morally neutral? I mean, the problems come when we don't discipline ourselves to not go to war easily, right? But is the technology itself at fault?
I don't think the technology is at fault, but technology is certainly not neutral. If there's one thing we know about new technologies, it's that case. Technology, when it's inserted into a complex system, even when it has great potential for gains, will often have unexpected impacts on the way we ourselves make decisions. And I think that's what we're seeing with the drone.
So we'll have to dig into this moral quandary. This is Philosophy Talk, Coming to you from the Mars Theater, our guest is Bradley Strasser from the Naval Postgraduate School, and we're thinking about the ethics of drone warfare.
What are the unique moral concerns raised by drone warfare? All things being equal, is it morally preferable to use drones instead of less precise weapons? Does drone technology make waging war too easy for politicians?
Drone warfare, civilian casualties, and ethically challenged politics, along with questions from our audience, our non-droning audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Grab a joystick, stay at home. Blow them up with mini drones. Tiny missiles, micro bombs. Kill them all, just don't tell mom.
Well, thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones, for that inspiring little ditty. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Bradley Strasser, author of Killing by Remote Control. And we're thinking about the ethics of drone warfare, and we'd love to have you join this conversation.
What do you think of the increase of drones under the Obama administration? Are drones better than boots on the ground and real planes in the air? What do you think are the biggest moral concerns about drone warfare? You can join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone right there in front of the stage.
So, PJ, I want to ask you about whether this technology, you think it's the technology itself that raises serious moral problems, or is the real problem just with the politicians and the society who decides whether to wage a war or not using drones?
Right. So I agree with Ken from before that there is a genuine distinct question here conceptually. There is the question of, in principle, do the drones have some kind of deep intrinsic problem inherent in their use? Examples would be like nuclear weapons. A lot of people think chemical weapons, these kind of things. A lot of us think, look, no matter which way you use these things, you're probably going to be doing something wrong, even if you were using them for a just cause. But drones don't seem to be like that. Drones seem to have certain characteristic ability at actually limiting the number of people that die in war, as well as protecting the operators. In the great piece from the Roving Reporter, we heard the young man Brandon, this awful story, talk about how he thinks you need to have boots on the ground because you need to care enough. You need to have a really good reason to go to war. I couldn't agree more that you need to have a really just cause. But here's the puzzle. If you have a just cause, and you really do believe you have a good reason to go to war, then you shouldn't want to risk your guys, right? And you shouldn't want to put boots on the ground if you don't have to. And drones seem to give you that ability.
Well, there's one thing about having to put boots on the ground. Suppose I threaten you. I think of the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. How did the Soviets know that the U.S. was deadly serious, that if you invade Germany, we will resist? How did they know? Because they put 200-some thousand troops on the German border, and they said, look, this is our treasure. We're willing to risk our treasure. So you know we're deadly serious, right? So the high cost we were willing to pay made the threat credible.
It made it credible, that's right. And that's how deterrence works. But drones actually seem to give us the inverse of this.
Right, exactly.
It's very surprisingly, they seem to suggest we have the threat, it's very credible, and we can do so without a tremendous cost to us.
It's credible because it doesn't cost.
Precisely. And it's such an inversion of traditional deterrence. Now, morally, you might have issues with geopolitics. I certainly do. But from a cosmopolitan view, not just your own people versus somebody else's people, from caring about all human beings, if you can have geopolitics waged in such a way that reduces the number of human beings put at threat, that seems to be a moral gain.
Well, like a lot of things, it depends on what you hold fixed and what you allow to vary. Now, if we just kind of hold our wars fixed and say, instead of using the other stuff, we use drones, maybe they all would have been better. I mean, Vietnam, we would have, not had to use all those horrible chemicals and soldiers coming back maimed and so forth and so on. But on the other hand, you say, well, but things aren't the same when you bring in this. They also make an effect. One of the good things about Vietnam was it was such an obvious disaster it took us another 20 years to do something as stupid.
Wish it had taken longer.
It should have, yeah.
That's right. General Robert E. Lee, the old Civil War general, he famously said, it is good that war is so terrible, lest we grow too fond of it. That's right.
So that's the other side, right? Drones lower the cost of a credible threat, and hopefully help us deter because we don't have to pay such a heavy cost. But it also lowers the cost of entry into a war.
That's right. Right?
And so it makes war more easy to decide. That was John's worry, right? It so lowers the cost of war that war might become too easy. What do you think of that?
I mean, from the American point of view, it's almost not like war anymore. It's like, well, you know, we're America. We should be in charge, but it's difficult because it costs lives and money. But now we can just be in charge by sending drones to any place we don't like in the world and killing very selectively. Is that a good thing for Americans to think?
I don't think so. I'm certainly not defending American foreign policy choices when I say this, but it seems to be the case that if you can say, look, if you believe you have a just cause, then you would want the cost to be as low as possible. Mm-hmm. This is precisely the problem. But when you lower the cost, of course, the worry is that when you make anything too easy to do, it'll be used wrongly. The old business world cliche, right? When you have a really nice hammer, everything looks like a nail. And you're going to want to use that drone because it's easy to use and you don't have to have the political capital, right, that leaders would have to spend in order to put their own citizens at risk. In a democratic system, you no longer have to spend that political capital. And this is a tremendous worry. It's a systemic worry. But notice the puzzle here. The puzzle is that the actual moral gain itself is what's driving this moral hazard.
So you said you had a middle ground between John and...
That's right.
I think what you have is a paradox.
I don't quite
see a resolution of the paradox.
That's right.
That is, the thing that lowers the cost of war makes it easier to do a just war, but it also makes it easier and more likely that there'll be, you know... Unjust. I mean,
That's right. You know,
mass war is a costly thing. So nations enter it reluctantly, except
that's
that they're
right.
fools like Hitler was or something like that. But, you know, nations enter mass wars reluctantly. But limited, you know, they used to talk about limited nuclear war.
Well, that's
that was
a joke.
Just a joke, an oxymoron. Right.
You can't have
but
a limited
now you can
war.
Really have limited war.
That's right. You mentioned earlier the tremendous number of deaths under the Obama administration's use of drones. And it's concerning. However, compare that to the incredible number of deaths lost under the occupation war of Iraq by George W., as you called him. So if you compare the forms of warfare, even though, of course, limited warfare is going to have tremendous harms and wrongs accomplished, it might be significantly truncated and mitigated compared to these large-scale operational
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater in Berkeley talking about the ethics of drone warfare, and we've got a question from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Steve. I'm from Berkeley. And my question is around the emergence of self-driving cars, self-driving trucks, and what are the moral and ethical implications of self-driving, flying, and shooting drones?
So you're wondering if drones could someday not be piloted by a human, but pilot themselves through artificial intelligence technology.
Correct. And the paradox you're addressing of making things easier, what happens when you can just roll these out and they fight the war on their own?
That's right.
What happens?
It's a fantastic question.
Is that coming?
Well, first of all, I hate to say I do think it is coming. And the reason I say I hate to say that because I think that is yet another threshold that is different in kind. It's important to remember the drones, as we call them today, I don't really like that word because it almost sounds like they're autonomous, but they're remotely piloted. The Air Force are the first to say that. They always say, call it remotely piloted vehicles, not drones, because there are human beings still in control. But you're right. The Department of Defense is investing billions of dollars to try to make these at least semi-autonomous. That is, the drone could make decisions. Decisions, whatever we mean by that. Now, I do have tremendous moral problems with this in principle. And the main one, there's many, but my main worry is it has to come down to moral judgment. Many of us think that these kind of life and death decisions require a human moral agent to make them. And if you don't have a human agent, a moral agent, making a moral decision over life and death, then you have a kind of category mistake.
Right, but I would imagine the decisions that you want to program the drone to make is targeting decisions, whether to fire or not fire, right? Give it some algorithm that calculates the cost, the damage, and all that. I mean, but behind that algorithm is a human decision.
We would design it, right, precisely.
We design it. We give weight to the competing factors.
Ken, you can go further than this. You could argue that they might be better than human beings
well,
in making these decisions.
Somebody said the other day, some guru like Bill Gates or somebody, 20, 30 years from now, we will look back on the era in which humans drove cars and we will say, how nutty was that? Now, the interesting thing is when we drive cars, we don't usually think of it as a moral thing, but occasionally
there are
crises come up and there are moral decisions.
Right.
Do I steer into the tree and maybe kill myself and my wife, or do I run over that kid that just ran out in the street? Legally, that will all change because somebody will have programmed that decision into the autonomous car, and they'll have to they'll have to have legal protections too.
That's right.
I would say, you know, I don't really look forward to autonomous drones, but if we could make sure that the autonomous drones made the value decisions according to a program designed by philosophers,
well, philosopher kings
might
what
not
we all
be
want,
a bad no. thing.
I'm with you in that I'm excited about the possibilities of autonomous cars, but the intention of a car, even when it does have a moral dilemma before us, is to transport people around. The intention of a weapon is to kill people, and I'm not comfortable putting the moral judgment of that, even if it's designed by humans, into an algorithmic artificial intelligence.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name's Robert. I'm from Berkeley as well. Aren't drones really a substitute for assassination now, something we used to be really bad at? And now you can, you know, with our means of gathering intelligence, which you'll never know,
right,
take out people everywhere, and it can't be good. It's uncontrolled. It has no checks and balances that you can think of.
So if we'd had drones in the Kennedy era instead of sending Castro an exploding cigar that didn't work, we right. could have taken him out with a drone. Would that have been a good thing?
That's right. Yeah, so assassination is interesting. And this, again, is this distinction between policy and the actual weapon, which enables that policy, right? You can't entirely separate them. So you're right to bring it up. You know, assassinations are strange. We say that different people are liable in war, right? That is to say, liable to be killed in war. I would ask, why is it that we think some 18-year-old kid I recruited out of high school, that he's liable or she's liable to be killed in war, but perhaps the politicians who make decisions about war are not? I don't mean to open a huge can of worms with that, but I just want to say that the questions of who should be killed in war and who shouldn't, who is a liable target, that's its own question. Now, did this kind of warfare enable that question to be really brought to the fore? I think it does.
But this kind of warfare, I'm going to talk on behalf of this kind of warfare. Look, if you could have found a way to take out Hitler, to decapitate German, the Nazi state, which did not involve millions of human beings clashing with highly destructive weapons, right? Which did not involve the carpet bombing of cities, attempt to grind down the German industry and all that sort of stuff. Surely that would have been morally preferable to mass war. I mean, surely, okay, there's an enemy state, and we want to decapitate that enemy state, but to do that by weapons of mass warfare
I agree completely.
Morally terrible.
However, remember, we're not talking here about killing Hitler. I imagine this gentleman would not mind if drones were killing Hitler. What we're talking about is, as you mentioned, we don't really know who we're killing. There's a tremendous lack of transparency, a tremendous lack of accountability in the current drone program, and that needs to change. If you have this great weapon that in potential theory could be used more morally, but yet the way it's used is shrouded in mystery and darkness, we don't know if we're killing Hitlers or maybe a young man who just happens to be carrying a weapon.
Yeah, you want to come back here, sir.
Just one further question. Do we have any evidence that assassination has changed anything at any time?
Very good point. The decapitation strategy, right? Does this really work?
Right.
Or is the void just filled and frankly maybe filled with more gusto?
Well, I think with Saddam Hussein, we didn't exactly assassinate him, but getting rid of him didn't exactly cure the problems.
It took a long time to get rid of him. It took a long time to find, even with all these boots on the ground, to try and find him and kill him. He was running around the rock forever. But I want to.
So we could have had this bad result at far less cost with a drone.
So look, I want to give you a test. I'm not quite sure what the answer to this. There are certain weapons we abhor the very thought that they might become ubiquitous. Nuclear weapons, I mean, that thought is abhorrent to almost everybody, but I kind of wonder if everybody had them, nobody would be able to use them because they're such destructive weapons. Okay, so if drones were ubiquitous, then every single potential belligerent would have global reach, right? You don't need to be able to, you know, U.S. feels safe mostly because we think they can't bring a mass. Nobody except the Soviets or the Chinese could possibly bring mass attack to U.S. shores. Right. Of course, they're these guys with box cutters. But suppose every potential belligerent had global reach. Would that be a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, right, this cuts right to the core of the puzzle, the paradox, as you say, that I grapple with here in this position I have, because Of course, it seems very awful right out of the gate to think of the ubiquity of drones. I will note that most major militaries today do have them. The U.S. are the ones using them, but most militaries today in advanced countries do have them. But setting that aside for a minute, the idea of global reach. I should point out that Al-Qaeda believe they have a global reach. They were based out of the Fatah region in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they attacked New York. So the idea of global reach is more widespread than drones. But I take your point. I think ubiquity of most weapons, like nuclear weapons, is awful. But that's because I think nuclear weapons can't be used justly in principle. I think any use of a nuclear weapon is going to violate any norms of proportionality or distinction, but drones aren't like that.
There's really a little philosophy that can be used here. I mean, when you think of intelligence, you think, well, you get information through perception, you perform an action, and it has a result. But an important part of that is you know what the result is ahead of time, mm-hmm. or at least you know what the result is after time. Now, a lot of weaponry is based on increasing our powers of action with no increase in the epistemology of the effect. Mm. I mean, even going back to the difference between hand-to-hand fighting and fighting with rifles or longbows, much less bombing with artillery shells, much less bombs dropped from 15,000 feet, much less nuclear bombs. So epistemologically, yeah. the drone really does stand out as something that actually is a new weaponry that doesn't decrease the knowledge we have of its own effects. And in that sense, maybe it's kind of promising.
It's a strange weapon in that it actually gives a credible distance, but at the same time, a shocking level of intimacy, right. as we heard in the Roving Reporter's report.
Question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Laura. I'm from San Francisco. And I want to talk about other effects of drones. So if we think about what happens when an area is being covered by drones, there's all of these drones, I guess, what is there another word for that? Flying about in the sky, and you know, they make all this noise, and it's different from if, like in the Second World War, when there was aerial bombing, and you hear the planes coming, they bomb, and then they're gone. But with drones, it seems like because they're doing a lot of surveillance, they're there for a long time, and you are living under this threat, this constant threat, and not knowing when it's going to strike, where it's going to strike. And that in itself, even, you know, forgetting about when it does actually strike, but what it must be like to be a part of a population in an area where there are a lot of drones and you just don't know what's going to happen, it seems like that would be really psychologically a horrible situation to live in.
The suggestion, it seems to be, that drone weapons are terrorizing weapons because they have a psychological
right.
effect that...
I would say that any kind of aerial warfare in a given population group is going to be pretty terrorizing. But I think Laura's right. This is a particular, peculiar kind of harm that needs to be accounted for in any kind of what we call proportionality weighing of the harms of warfare, whether or not it's justified. And so you can't just look at the harm done to civilians as those that are killed or those that are injured, but also the entire population group that lives daily under the constant drone of the drones. And this has been captured in some recent studies. Stanford NYU Law Center, in conjunction, they worked together and did a report called Literally Living Under Drones that made precisely this point. If that harm isn't captured, you can't possibly think about the actual use of drone warfare.
Well, this is fascinating stuff, really worth digging into even more. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the ethics of drone warfare with Bradley Strasser from the Naval Postgraduate School.
How do we, the citizens, make sure our leaders use drones in the most ethical way possible? We need greater transparency and accountability, don't we? Or does our national security rely on keeping drone attacks secret? Maybe drones wouldn't be useful if we had more transparency and accountability.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
So remember when you tell those little white lies that the night has a thousand eyes.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones, who remind us that even if drones aren't used to kill us, they could make our life miserable in a lot of other ways. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about the ethics of drone warfare with Bradley Strasser, author of Killing by Remote Control.
BJ, given all the secrecy around the CIA, which I guess is inevitable, and military use of drones, what do you think the citizens of a liberal democracy can do to make sure these weapons are used in the most ethical way? I mean, if some, right, you know, presidential candidate, Bernie Sanders, say, who was willing to listen to reason, ask you to draft a drone policy, what would it be?
You know, on this issue, it is the real deep-seated problem with the actual use of drones that I see in the United States, and that's that there simply is not anywhere near the level of transparency, and then, of course, resulting accountability you can have. That said, again, we have one of these paradoxes, because the intelligence and the information used in these drone operations, understandably, is the kind of thing that makes sense, you might say, for a security apparatus to say, we need to keep these things secret. If we give these, if we tell you everything we're doing, then our enemy will know these secrets and it won't be effective.
So I think there's a, back to the accountability thing, though, in general, I think there's a problem that we have, right? War used to be, require the mobilization of the entire citizenry in some way.
Right.
It used to require sacrifice from lots of different people, not just the people who were conscripted into the war machine, but the whole society. Okay, we had this draft, for example. Mm-hmm. Nixon ended the draft. Why did Nixon end the draft? Not because he was a liberal do-gooder. He was the last. That's the last thing he wanted to do. He thought that by ending the draft, he would end the anti-war protests. He would suck the lifeblood out of the war anti-war movement, and he would be able to continue the war. And you know what? He was pretty much right about that. Mm. Right now, we have this all-volunteer army. What percentage of our citizenry?
That's right.
Was discomforted even by the Iraq War. Right, some people were morally outraged, but how much, what percentage of our citizenry was put on the line, their blood to be spilled? Yeah. Right, okay, I think that makes less resistance to war in the citizen because they're not aroused by war as much.
That's right, there's a sense in which it should hurt.
Drones take that, especially if drones become a primary instrument of war, drones take that even further. So there, I don't know how in a democracy, if you have this weapon that enables us not to impose costs on the citizenry.
That's right.
I mean, the citizenry doesn't just get up and, by and large, get aroused out of moral pique. It's when their blood and treasure
maybe
is
in Berkeley,
wasted.
But not many other places.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
You know, I agree. This is a serious problem. And it's not just with drones. Notice the conversation we're having now actually isn't just about drones, but it's about the ever-increasing military technology superiority of the United States and coupled with the incredible disconnect most of the citizenry has from that military use. These are some reasons you might think that there's other ways we could resolve some of these worries as opposed to saying, well, we can't use the better technology we have because of these problems. Perhaps we think about bringing back a draft for liberal reasons. Perhaps we bring an idea that we say war should cost and hurt all citizens to some sense so that they feel the pain to have a public accountability and outcry. Perhaps we should think about these alternative measures.
I want to ask you one more quick question because I want to go back to the Roving Philosophical Report because we haven't talked about the effect on the drone warriors. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that fellow unusual or usual? I mean, prototypical or atypical? Or
in my experience, so I've interviewed a lot of drone pilots as well. He's atypical. I mean, first of all, his story is awful. He's atypical that he's sadly on the street and in this horrible place. He's not atypical in that he is deeply, viscerally impacted by the killing that he did via drone. So this is important to note. The PTSD you hear about with drone pilots and the way that they're impacted, this, I hope, puts to bed the idea that the drone pilots don't take it seriously, if nothing else. It's not a video game. You don't get PTSD from a video game. On the other hand, of course, you could still make the case that if we had to put Brandon, let's say, his life on the line in warfare or have him fly this remotely, you could say we have an advantage.
But that's true, but we're putting the soldier in a situation of cognitive dissonance, as it were.
No question.
Because most soldiers, except for ballistic missile pilots or maybe submarine pilots, but even though they're in the theater of war, and everything around them is in this theater of war, and and lots of people are in the same boat, but these drone pilots, they operate in the theater of war, but they live with their families and their community, and then they can't talk about what they do.
It's
the
very
whole
strange
support
it's very
mechanism
abnormal
that you would have of your.
So I think there might be a fallacy at play here, though. If you think that is a in principle objection against drones, I just don't think it's going to work. First, let me agree with you. There is a cognitive dissonance. I mean, these guys they'll fire a missile and then they're going to go home to their PTA meeting or their kid's soccer game. That's odd.
Right.
That's new. But I don't think as an objection against the weapon in principle that it's going to necessarily hold water. For starters, I know this sounds silly, we could change that, right? There's no reason to have drone pilots operate the way they do. You could have them operate in a deployed environment. hell, you could have bombs go off around them or something silly. Well, I mean, you could really be ridiculous.
That seems a little, yeah.
Of course it's ridiculous. My point being is that it seems that the kind of dissonance you're describing, while real, doesn't seem in principle to put a
yeah, I wasn't really worried. I wasn't so much talking about whether it's an in principle objection.
Right.
But it's a weird situation.
It's a new form of warfare.
In warfare.
It's new and strange. And because it's so new and strange, I don't think we've really had the time yet, or really the experience or the data as well, empirically, to really understand what that does to our pilots.
Well, about 15 or so years ago, I had an optimistic thought. Which was,
and then you lie down and it went away. Yeah, right?
You know, most of our wars are really rooted in ignorance. I mean, start with World War I, which was the, you know, the
stupidest war in history.
War in the 20th century, anyway. And you know, you can see lots of depictions in movies in that, but the historians tell us it's accurate. They didn't know what they were getting into. They were completely deluded. And if they had known, they would have maybe not gone to war. But you can say that right up until the invasion of Iraq. But since then, things have really changed dramatically with the internet. You know, you can't imagine. I can't imagine going into World War I without people on the internet telling you what it's really going to be like. You can't even imagine George Bush and Cheney getting us into Iraq with the internet rather than just a couple of places like the New York Times that were kind of sold out. And I thought that was my optimistic thought. The internet is going to make it much less likely that we bungle into war because we don't know the consequences.
Because the idea,
but now technology
that's right.
of warfare has taken that away. So I'm back to depressed thoughts.
Well, I share a lot of your cynicism. I mean, on the idea that the information revolution, right, the idea that people can't really have secrets kept from them about the causes or arguments for war, they can't be as duped as easily. I want to be hopeful, but on the other hand, as we just spoke about, if the kinds of warfare which are more limited now being waged in secret aren't publicly available, then how can you have that public debate in a country?
And plus, you know, the Bushies thought, look, the Middle East is a mess of a place. They thought, well, we need to remake the Middle East. We need to install a liberal democracy somewhere in the Middle East besides in Israel, right? And that's going to help, right? As if somehow we had the power to do that. I don't know what could have driven that delusion away from them.
Well, there were a lot of people. Well, you go back to Vietnam. There were a lot of people who knew a lot about Vietnam when our administration got us into a war based on not knowing about Vietnam. I know because I was a graduate student. I went to the library and found out a lot of information that the Secretary of State could have found out. But it was the same with Iraq. I mean, a lot of people knew the difference between a Shiite and a Sunni before we started the war. Right. But there's just no way those people could get listened to. Now there is. But now we probably would have sent a drone over to assassinate Saddam Hussein before anybody knew we were even thinking about it.
Let's get a questioner in here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
My name is Ben. I'm from San Francisco. And I'm curious, sir, what do you say to the young naval, I guess they're not cadets, they're on their way to becoming...
At the postgraduate school, they're already officers.
They're already officers.
About mid-career.
So how do you, what is it you say to these mid-career military people about this issue? How do you prepare them for what they're getting into?
Well, my students at the Naval Postgraduate School have already been in this issue, so I'm often asking them, what has it been like? But this is an interesting point that Ken and I have had discussed before. Do you want your education in the military environment, whether that's the undergraduate academies or the graduate schools, do you want to challenge these young men and women, or not young necessarily men and women, on these ethical issues? And I'll give you my answer as a resounding yes, right? Of course, you want to challenge them on these things and make them wrestle over the justice, not just of the wars that they fight, but the justice of wars in general. I don't think pacifism is a foregone conclusion to just hand wave it away. You want to ask them these hard questions and make them wrestle with them. If nothing else, maybe here's a reason for optimism, John. Perhaps surprising to you. The U.S. military does a surprisingly good job of actually getting its military members to grapple over these tough questions.
So I hear tell that one of the differences between our military and militaries of certain of our adversaries over time is that we do train our officers especially to be thinkers, to be independent thinkers, to be innovators, and even to ask morally challenging questions. Of course, there is a chain of command, and ultimately when the chain of command speaks, you listen, but we don't try to make our officers into robots.
We don't. And you know, there is a chain of command, but I will say these brave women and men who fight in these services, I mean, I don't always agree with foreign policy decisions the state makes. They don't either, I should note. But what I'm most impressed by is not their physical bravery and courage, but many of them have tremendous moral courage in the sense that even with the chain of command and with their training, they are not afraid to stand up often in the face of a command that they believe is wrong.
I mean, there is a point where the commander says, sit down. The decision is made, and you disobey him at your peril.
True, but you'd be surprised the number of people who do.
But, you know, this has been a fascinating conversation, BJ. Unfortunately, we can't continue it now, but I'm going to thank you for joining us, and maybe we'll continue it some other time.
Thank you so much.
If we're not destroyed by drones. Yeah.
Our guest has been Bradley Strasser. He's a professor of philosophy at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and author of Killing by Remote Control, The Ethics of an Unmanned Military. So, John, what are your thoughts now? What do you think about this issue?
Well, I go back to the remarks by our audience member, Laura, about having drones all over in the song by the Playtones about eyes in the sky. Even if we don't have drones as killing machines in the sky, we may be faced with drones delivering things and being used by private eyes and what is that show on TV, Cheaters, and so forth and so on. And so I read somewhere that the U.S. government was grappling with its policy on non-military drones. I have a simple solution. No drones. No drones at all. If you see a drone, you know it's a war drone.
Oh, you know what? You're a Luddite, John. You can't reverse the progress of technology. So we're in a brave new world, and we have deep, complex issues to think about, and you know, that's why it's new work for philosophers to do. We have a problem that philosophers, in terms of just war, in the past never had to face.
So you're looking on the bright side.
Yes,
yeah,
I always
drones
do.
May kill a lot of innocent civilians, but they create new work for philosophers.
There you go. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, now get this, cogito ergo blago. I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from a man who never drones on. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, worried discussions about the uses of drones in warfare have been deployed around other weapons over the years, including atomic bombs, bombers, missiles, submarines, machine guns, poison gas. One such weapon that helped seal the deal at Agincourt back in the day was the longbow, also called the Welsh longbow, the machine gun of the Hundred Years' War. More than a simple bow, each longbow was made from a single 6-foot length of yew wood. To get more force in the arrow's flight, the bowstring would be drawn back all the way to the archer's face. This required all of a man's strength to bend the bow, not only in his arms, but his upper body and legs. Each time the bow was drawn, it was the equivalent of lifting 180 pounds. And during the heat of battle, archers were asked to unleash 6 to 10 hours a minute. In 1542, Henry VIII set a minimum practice range for adults using flight arrows of 220 yards. Longbows were used in battle two ways, either to create a storm of arrows raining down from the sky, or a simple point-and-click sharpshooting, one arrow, one-man archery, usually from the flanks of a battle. In the 12th century, Gerald of Wales commented on the power of the Welsh longbow. He saw a man of arms and horseback get shot. The arrow went through his thigh and legging and tunic, through the saddle, and so deep into the horse was killed. Robin Hood aside, it was a tough life for archers. They were trained from childhood year-round with bows getting bigger as they got older. Skeletons of longbow archers have revealed enlarged left arms and often bone spurs on the left wrist, shoulder, and right fingers. In an era in which warfare was usually seasonal and non-noble soldiers spent part of the year farming, the year-round training required for the longbow was a challenge. Over the years, there became a bowman shortage, and after several generations, yew trees began to be scarce, causing compulsory imports of yew with every ship that came into England. In 1562, the Bavarian government sent a plea to the Holy Roman Emperor, asking him to stop the cutting of yew, outlining the damage done to forests by its selective extraction. And then came gunpowder. The longbow was displaced by the arquebus, which was easier to use but often exploded, killing the shooter. A longbow did not have this problem. The arquebus was displaced by the musket, which was displaced by the rifle, which was displaced by the machine gun, and the whole world went to hell on a handcart, which was also first introduced during the Hundred Years' War. Today's handcarts run themselves to hell using simple algorithms created by Uber. So buckle up and keep watching the skies. I gotta go.
Philosopher's Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Kelly Witters, James Hanley, Dan Brandon, and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and also from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.